Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 109, Man of Peace.
So good morning and happy Tibetan New Year again. Here we are on the ninth day of the first lunar month, a day in which the Buddha performed his ninth miracle of the 2 weeks of miracle that he performed. And working up till the 12th, which is the full moon, where he did like another one, you know. So this is Tibet, they celebrate this. They take 2 weeks off, everybody, the whole country takes 2 weeks off from the Lunar New Year, and they party for a day or two initially. And on the night before, the New Year's Eve, they do a ritual of getting rid of the negativity of the old year. And then for 2 weeks, they have... In Tibet, they had Dalai Lama would give lectures on former lives of the Buddha and on sort of general thing to the general populace. And on the 15th, he would especially do it. Nowadays, in Dharamsala, he gives a lecture on the 15th, full moon day, that is, the lunar 15th, the full moon day. And not necessarily on every day, but in general, it's a very time when people sit back and concentrate on the spiritual aspect of what they're talking about and what they're doing. And so we're not doing one every day, but we're doing this second one. And the topic today that I want to talk about is about His Holiness the 14th, the great 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet. And because I'm very excited this morning, because last night, I didn't see it, but I saw it on YouTube just now, John Oliver did an amazing, last week today, he did an amazing rundown of the Tibet story, just out of the blue. I'm not sure why or how, but I'm so happy that he did, and he did a really great job. And I'm more than ever a Don Oliver fan now. And he even went to Dharamsala and did an interview with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, recently, and had a really fun time and nice chat with him. But before he did that, in the introduction, he gave the full story. China invaded in 1950. China claims Tibet is 1/2 of what it actually really is, the size of it. And then the human rights, horrible lockdown that it's been under for a decade now almost, and about a decade, and how the 146, or I think it's over 150 now, body immolations, giving of one's body into fire, as they call it. They don't actually call it in the Tibetan language self-immolation, like we do, because they consider the self is going on to another life. But they are giving up the body, so it's a body immolation. Ranglu Mela Puwa, or Mela Sekwa, or Mela Jimba, they have such an expression. So Ranglu, one's own body, one is giving to the flames. And he talked about all of that, and then he talked about how the Chinese kidnapped the 6-year-old or 5-year-old Panchen Lama recognized by Dalai Lama, which is the tradition, which he had initially been asked to do during a time when some people in China thought there was going to be a thaw. But by the time that it happened, a few years later, there was no more any thaw. And so then the Chinese kidnapped him, and then they made their own Panchen Lama, which, of course, was silly, as Dalai Lama said in an interview with John Oliver, where because the Tibetans, of course, don't accept their Panchen Lama. They think it's a fake Panchen Lama. So the whole strategy that they make a Panchen Lama, then that Panchen Lama recognizes their Dalai Lama, is silly because it doesn't serve to be a puppet or to control the Tibetans, because the Tibetans won't recognize either one, And Dalai Lama did say that the brain was not thinking strategically in a more intelligent way of the leaders who were doing this. And I think he particularly meant, I don't know if he knows who exactly that is, but I think I do. Guy who used to head the United Front and is the one who gives the Politburo, the Standing Committee, the very bad advice of how to crush the Tibetans instead of how to make the Tibetans happy, where they become your ally and they become a great citizen of China because they're happy with you because you're treating them well and treating their lamas well, which would be the intelligent thing for China to do. You know, that's the way you have, you know, a pluralistic country, you know, where you can't just, you know, crush everybody in a meat grinder to the same, you know, burger, whatever. Anyway, I was so excited about it, and it was such a great interview, and I recommend you find it on YouTube, John Oliver and the Dalai Lama. It's totally great. Because today, what we're coming up on is that on Amazon, starting on around the full moon, the paperback goes on sale, and soon after, the ebook goes on sale. The hardback is already on sale, a little expensive, but it's already there, called Man of Peace, the Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And this is a book that I co-wrote with two co-authors, one who sort of had the plan of it initially, but it didn't know some of the parts of the Dalai Lama's life. He had originally thought of doing mainly just the part up to where he escapes from Tibet, up till 1959, from birth in 35 to 59. That was the first 24 years of his life. And then I knew more about the part since he's been out and what's been going on in Dharamsala, because I've been kind of traveling together with His Holiness on that path. And so we want to talk, we're launching the book, in other words, which is published by Tibet House, and the proceeds from the book all go to help the preservation, therefore, of Tibetan culture. And in a way, it is totally on our mission because His Holiness the Dalai Lama is our founder. But more importantly, in this context, he is the ultimate artifact of the Tibetan Buddhist culture, of this very refined and sophisticated and cheerful and intelligent and skillful and compassionate culture, which produced, after, you know, 1,400 years of function, because Buddhism only reached Tibet around 600 or 700 of the Common Era, it produced this culture where some people became so enlightened that they could lucidly die. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, the expression lucid dreaming. So there are some people, and actually almost everyone can train themselves to learn to lucidly dream, which means, you know, you fall asleep and you create like a mental, you project a mental wish, determination, that when you rise in a dream, when you have a dream, that you're going to be aware that you're in the dream and you're embodied in a dream environment and your things are happening to you in a dream. And you know that it's you dreaming, but you don't wake up from that. You know, in other words, everyone for a split second has that when they wake from a dream, and then they remember the last bit of the dream just as they're waking. Sometimes the dream, if it's a bad dream or a very, very good dream, very pleasant dream, it could awaken them, you know, the impact of the dream. So therefore, the split second they lucidly dream, in the sense that I know I'm dreaming, but then bang, their consciousness is awake. So you can train yourself to stay dreaming while knowing you're dreaming. And that's called lucid dreaming. There's a guy called Stephen LaBerge who teaches how to do that very nicely. He worked at Stanford in research labs for a long time. And in Moses Maimonides Hospital, they've done a lot of experiments with that. A great famous psychologist in California called Charles Tart did amazing experiments with that, with clients, with patients and so forth. And lucid dreaming is a skill you can acquire. Well, this culture, people became so self-aware, so focused in meditation, not all of them, but the ones who specialized in these studies, in the curriculum, let's say, that Tibet inherited from India, from all the great yogis and the great adepts and the great, it's what I call psychonauts of India, and scholars and philosophers, you know, of Indian Buddhist culture in these vast universities that they had all over India. And that's where all of this kind of research and stuff was collected over 1,500 years. And then the Tibetans inherited it, or they shared it with the Tibetans. And then when it was wrecked in India by invasions, because the universities were all burned down, the libraries and the monks and everyone, then the Tibetans kept it alive until now for the last 1,000 years. And what kind of culture, therefore, is it that produces people who can lucidly die, can lucidly go through the after-death experience, which they all say is like the experience of a dream, and know that they're in the after-death experience in a subtle body, like a Matrix-type body, you know, like Neo, remember, or even the Agent. You know, they have this Matrix body where they know that it's made of programming. It's made of, they know how it's made. They're conscious of every element of it. And then in that between state, they go and they find a rebirth situation. And in the case of Tibet, they come back to somewhere where they know they will be rediscovered, or they will reintroduce themselves to their former students, you know, because they still have things to teach them. And so the 14 Dalai Lamas are actually, and there were more, but they only started counting in the 14th century, but there's more like 20 or 30 in a lot of these incarnation lineages, because they go back even into India before Buddhism is in Tibet, historically, all the way back to Buddha's time in the case of the Dalai Lama, and other lamas as well. And so that's kind of an amazing culture. And then in general, it was fairly nonviolent. They demilitarized over, it took them about 600-700 years, but they more or less demilitarized, you know, in the sense of didn't have a big military budget. They had a few troops here and there, bodyguard type things. But, you know, when they were no match at all for the Chinese invasion in 1950 because they didn't really have an army. And most of their budget went to their universities, monastic universities, which also taught lay people. And they also didn't, they were so huge, they didn't teach even all the monks. There were some uneducated monks who were sort of working monks or praying monks, serving monks, but who didn't really study. But then the sort of top people, top of the class people, they became these extraordinary people who could remain aware of their continuity, of their personal continuum through the death-rebirth process, and actually describe how to do the death-rebirth process, which is very useful for us. Nowadays, people are somewhat learning this around the world, the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is not the proper title of it, because nobody's dead. You just go through a door, and you leave the body, and you're in another subtle body, then you go through a bunch of other doors, then you're back in a womb, if you're going to be born as a human, and or a mammal. And anyway, that's this amazing culture. So therefore, a great being like the Dalai Lama, who is extremely intelligent and wise and a great teacher, who is extremely compassionate and kind and therefore a great example, and is a very good leader for people, through his people, through this extremely difficult time they've had since he was born. And actually, in our Man of Peace book, we start with his predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, who, in fact, who was the Dalai Lama who first started really meeting foreigners, other than Mongolians and Turks and Nepalis and, you know, there's some people local around Tibet. But he met, like, American ambassadors, Russian ambassadors, and things like that, because the British invaded Tibet in 1904, when he was in office, you could say, prime of life, and he fled to Mongolia and eventually to China for some years, and he met all kinds of foreigners, and he realized what the modern world, with its machinery and its industrialization and its militarism, and he realized what it was like. And then the Chinese Empire, Manchu Empire, collapsed, and he ran away from the last empress and et cetera, who actually decided she wanted to have him assassinated. Although they had a traditional relationship, the Manchu emperors, who are not Chinese, but they were dominating China for 300 plus years. And he had a relationship with her predecessors, but she got all grumpy and she knew that everything was coming to an end, so she did that. And he escaped her. Then he went to the British in India to be, went for refuge to them. Originally, he had fled them to Central Asia and to China and to Manchuria, and then he came back and fled from the last remnants of the Manchus into India. And then he worked with a wonderful man named Sir Charles Bell, who was the Indian representative, the English representative in India. Remember, that was the British Raj. And Sir Charles Bell tried to help the Tibetans get some of their land back in the east from the Manchus and the nationalist Chinese after that. And he tried to help Tibet in various respects. And the 13th Dalai Lama started the whole process of trying to modernize Tibet, realizing that if Tibet itself didn't modernize to some extent, at least infrastructure-wise, and the Tibetans are very clever, and they can, like the Japanese, they could have they could have very quickly adapted to be making industrial things and working with machinery. That's really not the sign of an advanced culture, but it requires certain cleverness. And Tibetans easily have done that in exile now and even under Chinese. And so we start there with the 13th. And then we in the 30s, then the 13th, however, due to British betrayal and British geopolitical cynical behavior, like they still do, you know, colonial behavior, they wouldn't introduce Tibet as its own nation to the League of Nations after the World War. And so during the sort of heyday of Tibetan independence in the 20s, in the teens and 20s, Tibet only was recognized by Nepal and Mongolia and, of course, by the British directly, but they never let on to others that they recognized it. They made a treaty about Tibet as its own entity with the Russians, with the Tsarist Russians, but that's all been lost. Anyway, and so then this was a bad thing because then later when Chinese invaded Tibet, they were able to sow confusion about whether Tibet was itself its own country with its own language, its own culture, etc., or whether it was actually truly part of China, which the Chinese have always claimed, the communist Chinese have always claimed, but is actually not true. Taiwanese also, I mean, the Kuomintang before that, the nationalist Chinese, also tried to claim that based on the protectorate that the Manchu Empire, which is not China, bigger than China, the Manchu Empire had with Tibet. Anyway, it's a little complicated, all of that, but this is very well sorted out in the comic book, in the graphic novel. And so we start there. And then the reason I mention it is that then the great 13th, when he saw what communism was, which he did by getting news from Mongolia, which he was always very close to, and how the Mongolians, trained by Moscow to be communists, turned on their own Buddhism and tore down the mainstream Mongolians' culture of a Tibetan, you know, Tibetan Buddhist, Mongolian Buddhist culture. And everything was destroyed and burned and monks were killed. It was a massive Holocaust in the 30s. In Mongolia, and when he saw that, he said, oh, this kind of thing is obviously going to happen to us here in Tibet, now that there's this modern transport and modern weapons and so forth, we're not going to remain, and they're not Buddhist, the people around us, and the communists are very virulently anti-religious. And so I'm going to die sooner than I need to, in 1933, he said, in order that I can grow up a bit by the time the communists, the Red Ocean, the Red Tide, as he called it, in a letter that he left, a prediction that he left, by the time the Red Tide rises and smothers Tibet and destroys us, and he made a very graphic prediction of the horrible destruction that would ensue in Tibet, I'll at least be old enough to be of some help as a leader. I can try to lead us in that difficult situation. So he died in 33, and then the present one was born in 35. And our 14th Dalai Lama, and then of course we begin how he's discovered, how he's held for ransom by a Chinese warlord because he's born in the far, far northeast of Tibet, right on the kind of boundary between China, Tibet, and the Mongolias. And in a way, I always like to think it's like the 13th had seen that house during his trip to China, and it was like him planting a boundary marker in the earth, saying, up to here is Tibet, guys, because I'm Tibetan and I'm born here, you know. And his family knew a local dialect of Chinese called Xining dialect of Chinese, or Seiling, the Tibetans call it, Seiling Hua, or Seiling Ke, and Xining Hua. And they know a lot of Mongolians. They're a little bit racially mixed, a little like the Mongolians. Those northeast Amdo, it's a place called Amdo, is the third province of Tibet that nowadays sort of doesn't exist anymore. It's been swallowed in the Qinghai province of China. Anyway, he's born there, and he gets recognized and brought up to, it's kind of a drama how he gets recognized. Everyone knows the story. He recognizes his objects from his previous life, and he says, I want to go to Lhasa. He recognizes the lamas who come to see him because they dress up like the head lama of the expedition, dresses up as the groom and dresses the groom up in the head lama's clothes, and he spots this deception and says, no, no, you're the Sara Lama. No, he's the horse guy. The little kid does, you know. And then so they recognize him, and then they take him up to Lhasa. So that's really fun. But, you know, the thing is, those first years, then the Chinese invade. Then he sort of has a time from 40 to 50 where he kind of grows up and studies. And there's a lot of stories that people don't know about how in 1947 there was terrible things happened in Tibet before the Chinese came, where different factions had an internal fight and one of the monasteries was wrecked. And during that period, in a same quick succession in a way, both the Dalai Lama's father and the Dalai Lama's guru, his mentor, someone called Retting Rinpoche, who was the Lama who led the search party or who sent the search party and who did the whole process of recognizing the Dalai Lama, where was he reborn, Retting Rinpoche, he was kind of framed or anyway fell out with the government and ended up dying in jail. People don't know exactly how, but probably murdered, assassinated. So in that time, and that was in the Dalai Lama was born in the year of the pig, 1935, and that 1947, therefore, is also the year of the pig. And the Tibetans have a tradition that every 12 years, when your own year comes up in the lunar calendar, the way the years are marked, that you tend to have a hard time, and you need to do therefore lots of specially good things, because it's going to be a tough year for you, type of idea, you know. And actually, in doing the Dalai Lama's life story and looking at it ourselves again in detail, I realize more than ever that really it's these 12-year gaps, you know, where good things happen for 11 years, and then there's setbacks every 47, 59, 71, 83, 95, 07. And now we're worried, unless a lot of better things have happened than now, because since 07 it's been rather bad, because China turned their administration in a very bad direction. And we're worried about 2019, what is going to happen? It could be really bad for Tibet. But so therefore, we better get better before that. I'm looking for results, not so much this year, but next year, 2018. A really good result, and then there might be some setback in 19. And then things will go well, I think, after 2020. Because I think the world has to change by 2020. I was actually assured that myself personally by a seer that after 2021, I would be happy. Maybe it means I'll be dead. I don't know. I'll be 80. But I think it means rather, and they said, no, you won't be dead. It's that the world will have changed. And you won't, you know how we're living now, you know, everyone knows that, even though this is miracle time, Tibetan New Year. And the miracle, one miracle to me yesterday was John Oliver bringing up Tibet to people. And people, you know, he interviewed some people out in the street in Times Square. And they all liked the Dalai Lama. They said, oh, yeah, he's great at peace. And they said what they associate him with. But then they didn't know anything about him or about Tibet. And one lady said, he's a leader of Hinduism? She was confused. But they all had good feelings and a tender look on their face, which is really lovely. But, you know, it's sort of the time the story was brought out more fully, which is why, of course, we did this book. And we love the book. We love doing it. And some people have said it's a masterpiece and they really like it. You see on Amazon, you know. And it's distributed to Hay House, to your bookstore. They can order it from there. Yeah, but Tibet House itself, the Cultural Institute of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is the publisher. So therefore, proceeds help preserve the culture. You know? So then the first Westerner that His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama got to know well is this amazing Heinrich Harrer guy, whose story we tell. Remember the. There was a movie, 7 Years in Tibet, in the 90s. I don't know if you saw it. Some of you might have, which basically is based on the title of 7 Years in Lhasa, I think, was the title of the book, or maybe 7 Years in Tibet, by Heinrich Harrer, who was a famous sort of champion German, actually Austrian, mountain climber, and who was vilified because, you know, during the 30s, he was a member of the Nazi Party. But you had to be because he was a German national, you know, Germany occupied Austria, and then it was part of the German national climbing team. So he wasn't really a card carrying, doing anything. And then he was in Asia when the war broke out with the British and, you know, the Battle of Britain. And so he was arrested and put in a prison camp by the British because he was in Germany, because he was going up into Nepal to climb K2 with the German climbing team. He was nothing to do with the German government, just a climber. But anyway, he was arrested. And then he escaped from that camp in North India and climbed with his friend Auschneider over the Himalayas for many months, and almost took him, I think, a long time, maybe a year at the time. And at that time, Tibet was very closed to the outside world by the British, and by the especially by the British, you know, in the 1940s. But he somehow got to Tibet, and then he ended up being kind of like a little bit Dalai Lama's first tutor about the modern world, and he fixed an old camera that was in the Potala, and that little kid Dalai Lama would get, they would somehow get a hold from, maybe through from India, from trade merchants coming from India, they would get some newsreels, and he would play the newsreels, and he would see, and he would ask, who's that, and who's this, and who's that. And so it was a beginning to... And he learned, they spoke in a little bit English. But actually, Hara learned Tibetan actually pretty well. He had a very, it's interesting, he was a very secular guy, and he didn't learn anything about Buddhism. And I'd known him for a long time. He passed away a few years ago, but I knew him for quite a few years, long after, of course. But his spoken Tibetan was flawless. He had a perfect accent. And he particularly knew the kind of locutions of Tibetan aristocrat lay people, because he was hanging out with them in Lhasa. You know, he didn't know the Dharma kind of talk and philosophical concepts and things particularly, but he knew a lot about the culture and the people, and he loved the people. He was very open and honest about them. They were rascals, you know, they were beggars, they were weirdos, they were ambitious people, they were, you know, like any bunch of human beings, you know. But he really reported back on the culture, and then he was beloved by Tibetans because during the long period after the Chinese invasion and when the Brits wouldn't stand up for Tibet and Nehru and the Indians wouldn't stand up for Tibet either, internationally speaking, because Nehru thought Mao would be their big buddy and never mind, let them have Tibet, who cares? We're going to be the big Asian people now, anti-colonialists, you know, neutral bloc. We're going to now rule, you know, Nehru thought, by his alliance with Mao. Meanwhile, Mao was not at all interested in allying. He was interested in taking territory from India and, you know, supporting all kind of problem people in India. And it wasn't helpful. Anyway, we show the whole relationship with Hara and watching the movies and everything in part two of the Man of Peace and his education and the hard times he had and the good times. And we try to show it. We always show things like we show that the World War starts in the 40s and the bombings, you know, and the Battle of Britain, we show that. So we, and then eventually the nuke, you know, that's dropped later toward the end of the war. So we show things happening in relationship to the world, because on the psychic level, on the morphic resonance level, on the spiritual level, Tibet, of course, is not isolated from the world, even though it was a British policy to keep them isolated, because they knew that, they see, the British Raj wanted Tibet to be a buffer state for India and to keep China away from India and Russia away from India. But they didn't want to have to garrison Tibet because of the altitude and the expense. And so the best way was to keep Tibet and to tell the Chinese, yeah, we know you're a protector of Tibet. That's okay. It's your sphere of influence or something. We're not gonna colonize or anything. But actually, they trade and they dealt directly with the Tibetan government, and Chinese couldn't do anything about it, so they didn't say anything. But then, meanwhile, they then don't let other people get to know Tibet, so isolate them, so that then you don't have to actually you can keep it as a buffer state, without any other countries in there, by pretending that China has it and not letting Westerners or other people go there. So that was sort of the British duplicitous policy coming from Churchill, actually, who was great defending against the Nazis, but he was a big colonialist, on the other hand, as people know. And it's very colorful how the Oracle gives advice, and they send a delegation to the UN, the delegation is rebuffed. And then we do show, and then the Dalai Lama has wonderful encounters, visionary encounters with Gandhi, but then the Dalai Lama at one point, when the Chinese first come to Lhasa, he escapes because he thinks that the communists might kill him or something in the 1951, and he gets to the border, but then he does not decide to go to India for refuge. He decides he wants to try to work it out with the Chinese. He can't kick them out militarily, but he's going to work it out. And maybe socialism is not so bad. He didn't like sort of the aristocratic intrigues and the things of the that were going on in Tibet. He wanted to reform Tibet, but the Dalai Lamas were always reforming Tibet. They're the ones who presided over finalizing the demilitarization of Tibet. They, in the same year, when Louis XIV built Versailles to bring the French barons into Paris and to try to make a nation instead of a regional, fractious regional entity out of France. That same century, the Dalai Lama built the Potala Palace, and he brought the aristocrats to come to live in Lhasa and serve that central government. And he deprived them. He took away their abilities to have private armies so that they wouldn't fight and have regional fights, and there wouldn't be a lot of competition and ego games between the aristocrats. So the Dalai Lamas had been reforming Tibet since the 17th century, as much as they could, depending on what they knew and who they were in contact with. And after the imperial system ended in 1917-18, during the 13th Dalai Lama's retreat, where the Manchu Empire, the Tsarist Empire, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and in a way the British Empire collapsed, and monarchies all over the place, everything changed, at that time. So the Dalai Lama liked the idea. Maybe he thought with the Chinese socialist help, not fully the young Dalai Lama being fully aware of the danger of communist dictatorship, but thinking of it as like, the people, he thought he would try to get along with them. So he went back to Lhasa, and the Chinese made this thing called the 17-point agreement, which they forced the Tibetan delegation to sign in 51. But that did say that in central and western Tibet, the two-fifths of Tibet that the Chinese called the Tibet Autonomous Region, in that area they wouldn't try to change the government, they would leave the Dalai Lama as head of government. They would slowly reform at the pace that the Tibetans would say, and they wouldn't do their class struggle, and they're depriving everybody of private property, the whole horrible thing that the communist thing does. They wouldn't do that in that part of Tibet. But what people didn't think was to the three-fifths of Tibet in Kham and Amdo, in the eastern part, where three-fifths of the Tibetans live, actually, which is outside of what is now called Tibet Autonomous Region, the Chinese divided up into four other Chinese provinces into what they call Tibet Autonomous Prefectures of those provinces. And they considered that agreement didn't govern how they could, quote-unquote, reform that part. So they did all this terrible killing of landlords and struggle sessions and thought reform and beating people and executing them as reactionaries. Horrible thing. And then they spurred a armed resistance by nomadic Khambas and Amdos in those times and killed hundreds of thousands of them. And it was really, really a very difficult and dangerous thing, that they did there. And then these people would sometimes escape into the central part, and this caused stress on the part where Dalai Lama was trying to get along with them. And then they started kicking out Dalai Lama's officials, and they started basically just treating him like someone they just had to keep happy as a PR person or something. But, he began to, by 55, at 56 already, he realized it was hopeless trying to get along with them, because they weren't really wanting to just help Tibet, as they pretended initially. They wanted to assimilate Tibet, that is, to wreck its culture, destroy Buddhism, destroy its it's intelligentsia, and make everybody into a Chinese communist, you know, and make them actually learn Chinese. And they took children away and had them sent them down to China in order to learn the language, thinking that they would sort of forget Tibetan. They're still doing that. And, of course, Tibetans still haven't forgotten that they're Tibetans, and they're still resisting. And I like to say nowadays somehow, it's like Tibet has been the whole plateau, the giant million-square-mile plateau, has been like the like standing rock resistance to a mechanized industrial militaristic power for 1950 to 1917, 67 years. And anyway, so by 56, you know, after 5-6 years of trying to deal with them, Dalai Lama realized they were just puppets. He realized they were killing his people, and they were, you know, it wasn't going to work out. And when he was at the absolute wit's end of despair, he was luckily invited by Nehru to come to the 2500th year anniversary in India of the Buddha's birth, Buddha's life, Shakyamuni Buddha, 26th century before the Common Era, 6th century BC. And he was thrilled, and he got a chance to go there. Mao was playing some kind of footsie with Nehru, so he let him go. And then he had an awesome time in India because it's a holy land for Tibetans. It's like going to Jerusalem for a Christian or a Jew, and or a Muslim. It's a holy land. And for all those three Abrahamic religions, so for Buddhism, India is like a holy land. It's the land of Buddha. And he had a great visionary time there, and it's wonderful, which we tell the story, the young Dalai Lama, and how everybody was so happy to see him. And it's amazing. People sort of know about the Dalai Lama something. They know it's something good. They don't quite know what it is. He actually had a visionary meetings with Gandhi in his mind and so on. But then his brothers had already come out. His two laymen, one monk, one layman brother, and they wanted him to stay and to seek military help from America and start a rebellion in Tibet with American support. But the Dalai Lama, even the young Dalai Lama's judgment was better than the brothers, and he knew that this couldn't work. In a way, they might have been able to hold them off in central and western Tibet if India had stood up to the Chinese. But India said they wouldn't allow their land to be a base for any sort of resistance to Chinese aggression in Tibet. You know, the Chinese were aggressing in Korea, right? And China, with North Korea and Russia, they were aggressing and trying to take the whole of Korea at the same time. If you remember your history, and we had the Korean War to stop them. It was a UN action, remember? But mainly we pushed it. And so there was some faction in our government in that time. Truman still, when it first happened, was still in. And then Eisenhower came in. But anyway, who thought that they should maybe have a second front with China in the back at Tibet. But the logistics were so difficult. And then India refused to cooperate. So they couldn't do it. And the Dalai Lama knew it wouldn't work. It would just be like a minor thing and people would be killed, and it was against Buddhism, and he thought nonviolence was the way even then. And that's very moving, his visionary things and his debates with his brothers, and we tell that. And in a way, he admires them, of course, for their patriotism and for their willing to risk their lives. And he admires the people they recruit in the guerrillas. And he admires them too, but he never supports it in the sense of let's all rise and let's do it. Because he thinks it's not possible. You know? So then again, there's this whole struggle when he's gone there, and before that, I should say, he had some fun times with Mao, which we talk about. No, we don't know that. That was in 56. He was invited by Nehru. In 54, he made his last best effort with Mao, with the Chinese, where he went down to Beijing, which was not easy. There was no roads. It was really difficult. And he got to know Mao and Deng Xiaoping. And people don't know that, but Deng Xiaoping was the one who was supposed to conquer Tibet. within the Politburo, it was his job to monitor and control and make decisions about the conquest of Tibet, which he considered that he succeeded in. So that's why he became so hardline again in the 90s, and it's when he was kind of in his dotage. And in the late 80s, you know, he tried to be moderate in the early 80s, but then he became very hardline in the late 80s and the 90s when Dalai Lama couldn't return because things were too awful in Tibet. And he didn't want to admit it. So anyway, he went down, he got to know them all, and there are these famous scenes where Mao loves him, of course, because the Dalai Lama, everyone loves Dalai Lama when you meet him. He's so nice and pleasant. He's not necessarily, you know, charming, and he doesn't like perform, but he's just it's a great presence, and he has such a wonderful field of altruistic intent and attention. And so he's just, when you meet him, he's concerned with your story, not his story. And he wants to be, he's there for you, and you really feel that. So people do like him, and Mao liked him and admired him. And so did, I guess, Deng, although I've heard another story about that, but there's no evidence, so we didn't put that in the book about Deng had some other plan. But but he, on the other hand, he, Dalai Lama, realizing how adamant Mao was against the Dharma, against spirituality, and he wanted all charisma to go to the head of the secular state. You know, he wanted to be himself worshipped as like the deity of communist China, you know, like the cult of Mao, right? So he didn't want any religious competition. He didn't want any Buddha or God or anything, you know, and that's why they cross religion. You know, those dictatorships do that because they don't want somebody that dictator has to kowtow to, some priest of some kind. So he had already done that, so he was close to Mao in a way. But then he had a bitter lesson where during the 55 and 56, when he got wind of all the slaughter going on in eastern Tibet, or that's to say outside, in the Tibet Autonomous Prefecture, is three-fifths of Tibet, but outside Tibet Autonomous Region, according to Chinese thing. He wrote to Mao, like, come on, tell your people to stop doing this. This is not the way to befriend our people and make them your friends and have them work in unison with you and be part of your dream of whatever, liberating everybody. And then Mao never answered, you know, and they went on with the violence. You know. So that's the first few, six up to 54, and then 56, his wonderful pilgrimage to India, where he goes to Gandhi's Samadhi. He loves seeing what's left of the Buddhist monuments. He liked Nehru, but he was a little frustrated that Nehru was so solicitous about the Chinese. And he loved visiting the monuments, the archaeological monuments, which is the great thing the British did in India originally, and the Indians since then have been continuing, of unearthing the tremendous architectural record and archaeological record of the tremendous impact that Buddhism had on Indian civilization for 1,500 years. Which has sort of been lost, actually, to the Indians themselves to some extent, except for the tourist and pilgrim-frequented monuments that they nowadays are beginning to take interest in. So that's another whole story. But anyway, he goes there and he has a great time. And then again, the brothers try to stop him from going back to Tibet. This is 56 now. But then his oracle, you know, and then the Dalai Lama has this great oracle who goes into like a trance within a certain ritual, and then the local spirit comes and possesses it, that monk who is the vehicle, the medium, and then that local spirit gives that deity or angel or spirit, or whatever you want to call it, gives all kinds of advice to the government. And even in the old days, they used to go in the parliament, because Tibet has had a parliament for centuries, not only just the head of the government, but also parliament, and since the 17th, 18th century. And they go to the parliament, and if someone's a traitor or considering like selling out or doing something against the nation, that oracle will use the psychic power of the spirit to identify that person. And I always like to say it would be as if in America, you know, you would have in the Congress, right, you have ministers. I think they have a Catholic, they have a Protestant, they have a rabbi. The Dalai Lama once held a prayer session in the joint session of Congress. Even so, they've had a Buddhist. I don't think they regularly have an appointed one. They should, because it should be truly pluralistic on it. They should have a Buddhist and a Hindu and a Muslim imam. And they may have invited one or two in, but they're not regular, I imagine. But they should. And then in addition, you have a representative of the first Americans, as the Canadians call them, or the Native Americans, as we call them, who is like a shaman, and who comes on the joint session and is possessed by the spirit of Crazy Horse, or some, you know, one of the great Indian medicine men. And then if there's a certain senator or a certain congressional representative who's stealing from the national treasury, or who's doing the will of some lobbyist and ruining some law or whatever, or making a crooked deal with a foreign government, you know, doing something against it, then that oracle in trance dancing up and down the aisles will finger that person. And he carries a ritual bow and arrow. He wouldn't shoot him with an arrow, but he would, like, point it at that person, saying that that one is a traitor, you have to investigate him, you know. And then they would take that seriously and do it. But that wouldn't, in other words, the medium pointing out, but it's a mixture of rational analysis and psychic things, which is so fascinating thing about Tibetan culture, because they wouldn't consider that the thing that the oracle had fingered, the media oracle medium had fingered the traitor, but they would consider that to be investigated, and then if they found evidence, then that would be the evidence. So in other words, that's just it's just a tip, let's say. You know, it gives them a license to investigate, something like that. And if you could imagine that in the U.S., we'd have really, I don't think we would have Congresses just obstructing the will of the people because of lobbyists like we do now, and just sitting there figuring out how to take more money from poor people and giving it to their rich lobbyists and rich corporate backers, like we are now caught in that sort of situation. And Tibet was well governed in that sense, actually, right? In its own way. Although there's always room for improvement, you know, as we now can certainly see in our case. So then that's very moving, though, how he, and then he has more visions of Mao, and I'm sorry, he has more visions of Gandhi. He particularly is inspired by Gandhi. And, of course, by Shakyamuni Buddha. And remember, at this time, 56, he is only 21, right? When he went to see Mao in 54, he was 19. So he's just that time where you really, and he, you know, he's really, Dalai Lama's really great. He, which we show here, he says always how he, when he was a teenager, he didn't care about his studies. He didn't want to study Buddhism. He wanted to play and go out in the, you know, do things. And he was very pent up and irritated, being stuck in kind of a certain type of school. But when he got to be in his late teens, I think after being invaded maybe, he realized he really had to study and learn Buddhism to sort of give himself the mental equipment to deal with the dreadful situation and to find something positive in the suffering of life, you know, which is what, find happiness, you know, which is the purpose of Buddhism, as you all know, probably, who are listening to me. You know, Buddhism is about happiness. Some people say it's not about happiness from Lama, I know, but he just likes to be contrary. I know that. He knows perfectly well that Buddhism is about happiness. The whole point, the popularity of Buddhism, popularity of Dalai Lama in Tibet by the Tibetans and now around the world is that, you know, he knows the path to happiness. And he's actually happy in spite of all the torment that he's been put through. And his people have been put through, and he very deeply identifies with his people. He's still happy. He's a happy person. You know, he's frustrated on some level by the stubbornness of the failing policy of the Chinese, thinking that the way to have a minority in a pluralistic culture is to be mean to them, terrorize them, frighten them. This is not a case of getting immigrants to leave. The Chinese in Tibet are the immigrants. This is a case of the Tibetans being on their own place in their own land and being the only ones biologically adapted to the land because it's this high-altitude land. So, you know, He's just waiting. He's constantly appealing. He's a man of peace. He's appealing to those people who are doing this genocide, which by various definitions what the Chinese are doing is not simply a cultural genocide, as the Dalai Lama more politely says, or what you might call an ethnocide. It's actually a genocide because they don't want to acknowledge that there is such a thing as the Tibetan people. They're just a kind of Chinese people. And the reason is they don't want anybody to ever be able to claim the true fact that Tibet was its own country, proven even by the biology. Who can live at 13, 14,000 feet? You cannot. You do not have. You have only 47% of sea level oxygen. You can go climbing there. You can spend a few weeks if you don't get altitude sickness, or a few months, even. Back and you can go back and forth, and you know. But you can't live continuously there. They get sick. Chinese women cannot form placenta, so they miscarry. They try to live in Tibet year-round. And Chinese men get chronic mountain sickness, CMS, which is where their heart and lungs really overwork, and they get strokes and heart attacks and all kind of arrhythmias, and horrible things happen to them. So therefore, even since the 50s, when they've been assigned to work there, they go down back to a lower altitude, two or three months at least a year, even 4 months from the beginning. They've never tried to, because they know they get sick if they try to stay there all year round. So that means they can't be living there. So it can't be China, actually. It has to be Tibet. But Dalai Lama's willing to have it be province of China. No problem. If they supported it, if they didn't, if they can mine, they can have some timber. They took already most of the easily accessible timber. And herbs and all kinds of richness, water, but, you know, not in an unsustainable way, not in a polluting, destructive way, like they have been doing. They've been wrecking the plateau, melting the glaciers, causing great danger to 3 billion people who live off the melted glaciers during the dry seasons in China, in Southeast Asia, in Mekong River, you're talking here, Salween, Irrawaddy, Brahmaputra, Ganges, Indus rivers, you know, all the way to Pakistan. The headwaters all come from Tibet. The glaciers in Tibet are the third pole. It's the water tower of Asia. That's where the water comes from between monsoons, which is some 7-8 months a year. If those glaciers fully melt, those countries, depending on those 9 major rivers and many minor ones, are in the soup. That includes China. So Dalai Lama just wants these people to come to their senses, and he feels the best way to help people come to their senses when they're locked in a pattern of aggression is to at least, on your side, remain peaceful. On your side, don't give them the excuse by reacting violently in the direction of them. Okay? So here's a beautiful... So I'm on page 89. I'm going to have to do more podcasts about other parts of the book and telling other stories in the book about meeting presidents and getting the Nobel Peace Prize and, you know, like representing the positive future in our very dangerous situation that we're in today. And, the Berlin Wall going down happened the same year he got the Nobel Peace Prize. Apartheid went down a year or two after that. It was a great moment in the turn of the 80s to the 90s. And all kinds of Mrs. Aquino, South Korea, a lot of democracies rose up everywhere. It was a really great time. But then it's all kind of gone in reverse, sadly. And until we're in a terrible time right now in the States, as everyone knows, in a chaotic time, you know, very, very difficult time we're in. But anyway, this is before that. This is in 59, while he was just coming back from India. He went against his brothers, and he listened to his own common sense and his oracles, and he realized he could not countenance a full-scale military thing to kick the Chinese out of Tibet, that it wouldn't work. It was also morally wrong. There's a Buddhist always have a pragmatic side as well as a principled side. And so he went back. And he had this vision around that time. He had this vision, and then he's saying here in the graphic novel, he has a vision of Gandhi shining light behind him. He says, the Mahatma was a noble soul, but his people were a huge majority and the invaders small in number. We 6 million Tibetans are so few, and our invaders 1,000 million. But still, he would have thrown all his effort into a nonviolent campaign for peace and dialogue. And then in the next page, he's sitting meditating in front of a Buddha without wearing his glasses, looking very handsome, actually. And then he says, a very good meditative posture. And he says, it says the realization grows in the square bracket. Then it says in the bubble, the Mahatma was a true disciple of the Buddha. For if the Buddha's teachings are truly followed, or the teachings of any religion that values love and compassion, they lead not just to peace of mind, but also peace among nations. And then he's bowing to a statue of the Buddha, which is not an idolatry. He knows it's not the Buddha. It's just a remembrance of the Buddha. Anyway, never mind. And so what must I do, he's thinking to himself in this bubble. My attempts at a peaceful solution to our problems have come to nothing, he said. I'm losing my influence over my own people. They are being driven to violence and barbarism, which I'm bound to oppose. If I oppose their violent religion, they lose their faith in me as their political leader. But it's more important they not lose faith in me as their spiritual leader. And finally, he decides, I must withdraw as their political leader if I am to keep my religious authority intact. Yet if I stay in Tibet, I cannot escape politics. So it's clear, sooner or later, I must leave my country. This is like 58, 57, 58, like that. He's saying, having this thought after he came back. And to help my people, then in the next page, I must widen my knowledge of the world. I must finish my studies and actually understand voidness, emptiness, the nature of reality. I must know reality clearly to face the world effectively. And then he's thinking about all his people, he's meditating, and he's a beautiful picture of him. Beautiful, our artists were so great. Steve Buccellato of the Media Magic Studio, I think his name in Los Angeles. He was so great, and he had a team of four other artists who were tremendous, three colorists and one penciler. He did thumbnails, based on our written script. And he was really terrific. And these artists are so talented. One American woman and an American male man, the penciler, and the American woman, the colorist. And then a Russian and a Jordanian, actually, because these things nowadays are worldwide things, global. Anyway, beautiful picture of him, his eyes shining, light shining out. He says, suffering together with my people intensifies my renunciation of selfishness. He's happy, he's trying to make spiritual progress. And my cultivation of the spirit of enlightenment of love and compassion. But above all, to help them, I need wisdom to understand the real from the false. And this is around the time he takes his final exam. So I think the next podcast on this, I think I will tell the 1959 so-called uprising of March 10th, 1959, that is celebrated, and we're coming up on the celebration of it here soon. So I think I'll do that in the next podcast. And so meanwhile, we'll cease this podcast by again remembering that even though Tibet seems hopeless, even though the U.S. seems like in a really difficult place, even though Syria and the Middle East seems like an absolute catastrophe at the moment, nevertheless, people are carrying on. You have white helmets in Syria. You have devoted spiritual people in Tibet trying to be peaceful. You even have, the Dalai Lama doesn't like, and nobody likes, the people who, the 150 Tibetans who have recently offered their bodies into the flames. It's a sign of showing that they do not that life is not worth it, that life in a state of constant mutual conflict is not worth it, but they're not going to attack angrily and kill some Chinese or fight anybody. They're going to just give away their lives. It's a kind of, in a state of extreme subjugation, in a way. It's an assertion that they're free. You can't kill me, in other words, by dominating me with force, because I own my own life, and I can give it myself, give it away myself. So you can't take it from me, which is bad for you to do. You know? There's a deep thing within this offering of the body, which doesn't mean anybody likes it. The people who do it certainly don't. It is immensely painful. And the leadership does not tell anybody to do that. No way. It tells them the opposite. Absolutely. Are you crazy? You have a precious human life endowed with liberty and opportunity and intelligence, and you can learn and you can evolve and you can be a greater being in another life. You know, so you should use the human life, even if you're having a hard time in it, to develop your patience and your intelligence and your compassion and so on. That's what you should do. Never, never, never prematurely shorten your life. Never kill yourself, as it's called. Of course, you can't kill yourself. Yourself goes on. If you think you're miserable, so miserable you need to kill yourself, then you're being silly, because your misery will go with yourself. You know, the Buddhism has a thing where there's no fixed, unchanging you. You know, you're not like a permanent platinum dog tag or something. You're not a barcode that's just uniquely you. Even you have certain genetic, your genome can be unpacked. It's always changing itself. And it's not a fixed thing. And it's a kind of mobile combination of things that you inherited and so on. So it's a continuum, but it's not a fixed thing. So Buddhism always has a teaching called selflessness, where you can actually viscerally realize that yourself is not a fixed, unchanging thing. And you are an interactive, changing, constantly moving and swimming process. You're like undulating through the universe as a constantly changing process, but you are a continuum. And that continuum has the capacity of extreme bliss and happiness. And that's what you want to evolve toward. And you, these are, this extreme bliss is more complicated than just the normal eating a chocolate cake, although chocolate cake is going in the right direction. Having a sweet tooth, I must say. But too much of it, we know that's, on the other hand, that's worldly. That's called the suffering of change, that kind of pleasure of eating chocolate cake. Because, of course, if you eat 2 pounds of chocolate cake, you're going to get sick. Whereas true bliss, the bliss of reality, the bliss of understanding, the bliss of wisdom, the bliss of love and compassion, is inexhaustible. And it doesn't change. And it always increases. The more you love, the more blissful you feel from within, rather than because you own something or somebody, the more blissful you are, and the more intense it becomes. And there's no limit to it. So actually, it's nirvana. And that was actually the Buddha's teaching, and that is the point of happiness, of the Buddha's teaching, is nirvana. That is the reality of the world, if we understood the world fully. You know, the scientist is looking there, and the big electron and the cyclotron, and atoms are crashing against one another, and they're not finding anything that doesn't dissolve and doesn't get smashed. But finally, they'll come down to a plane of pure crystal diamond quiescent energy, the zero quantum point infinite energy field, and they'll realize that it's love, that it's bliss. That's the deepest energy. Anyway, that's what Buddha's discovery was. That's what the Buddhists have been pursuing for thousands of years. And that's what many, many millions of them achieved, but by no means all of them, of course. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to do it. All the great religious teachers, their founding movement was based on them discovering some aspect of that, whether they called it God or love or Brahma or whatever, or Jehovah or Allah, whatever they called it, they discovered this plane of infinite love, actually. So you can find that, because it's reality, the point is, it's not the property of a religion. It's not, you know, you don't just find God because you know the word God. If God was there, you would find it if you explored reality, if it's real. And in a way, that energy, you can call it God, because it is It is that which makes everything possible, actually, pure love. But maybe it's not a person belonging to a specific culture speaking only a specific language, if we really went deeper into it, but I won't do that now. But anyway, so this is the miracle. So the miracle I'm excited about today are three. One, the world is here, and it's a beautiful and amazing world. Two, even in the time when people are badly informed and things are kind of chaotic, John Oliver can go and talk to the Dalai Lama and can tell people in half an hour pretty much the story of Tibet and show actually clips and films and everything and have the cute younger Richard Gere praying to Deng Xiaoping to relent and open his heart with love for the Tibetan people. It was so sweet. And that's a miracle. And it's a miracle that after 10 years, 20 years on the part of one of my co-authors in the early part, and 10 years on my part and my other co-author's part, we managed to produce this final graphic novel, a version of the Dalai Lama's life, which, and by the way, his own autobiographies, of course, are there. There's a couple of them. And he has, you know, so he reflects on things and blogs and other things. So there's information about what he, which we all researched. But he never will show himself doing something really successful or being really great. You know, he won't want to show that. He's a humble Buddhist monk, simple Buddhist monk, as he always says. But although he said he was a little intelligent to John Oliver, and then John Oliver accused him of a little arrogance, and then they both laughed. I think they were really cutting up and cute. You've got to see it. And I loved it, you know. And I want to go see John Oliver myself. And anyway, and I always want to go see Dalai Lama myself. But anyway, so I don't know. I forgot what I was talking about. But oh, yeah, the third miracle is that we actually produced this book. It's out there. Now, young people can see, and it has a lot of action because there are some bad guys, and they are the communist Chinese invaders of Tibet. And there, of course, are Tibetan bad guys, too. And there's Western bad guys and all kinds of things. Nixon is in there, Kissinger, you know, Bush, the different Bushes, Reagan, the Chinese leadership, the Indian leadership. So, you know, because he met all the kings in Europe, you know. He's met everybody. Angela Merkel is in there. So there's action. And, you know, what the final action of the drama is it's a miracle to tell a story in a day of universal chaos, like increased militarism, you know, autocracy rising. We thought 10 years ago that democracy had won the universe, or 15 years ago, rather, we thought. And now we realize that democracies are kind of getting confused by money, and we're having autocracies and oligarchies everywhere. But even in that time, there can be a man of peace keeping alive, standing against an empire of dictatorship, you know, of a military-industrial dictatorship, you know, armed to the teeth, huge army. You can stand against that nonviolently, seeking dialogue, not hating those who are trying to kill him and his people, but seeking dialogue, since patiently explaining to him, it's not helpful to you to kill us. Much better to have us as your friends and helpers, which we'd be happy to be if you give us a break. And that it's a miracle to tell his story and get it out there. Really.